We are continuing our study of this unusual but crucial book of Ecclesiastes, so I'd like to invite you to turn there to chapter 7, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, and we're about halfway through this in chapter 7, and today we'll be picking up at verse 15. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, starting in just a moment at verse 15. I always enjoy getting notes from some of the children after the different messages here at church. And a couple weeks ago, two of the girls gave me a little slip of paper here with a bunch of numbers on it. And it was their expression of what they learned that day, but it was written in code. So they gave me a clue as to how to figure this out. And I hadn't had a chance to do that, but we figured it out on our way in this morning. And here was what they learned. Death. Lots of it. That's not a bad summary of some of the things in chapter 7 especially. I assume I got that right, girls. If I misinterpreted, let me know. But that's right. All right. Well, thank you, Lizzie. So, anyway, some of these statements in here are a bit hard because they are pointing us to some difficult things of life, and including the matter of death. Actually, our text today is going to take us to one of the hardest to interpret statements in the book, and to some challenging truths that arise from it. And I'd like to begin by just reading three of these verses, actually verse 16, 17, and 18. Listen to this. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Now, I've always thought about this verse as something that somebody might be tempted to use when they're in trouble. Maybe they disobeyed their parents and they've been confronted. Or a kid is sitting in front of his principal's desk, called to account for some wrongdoing. Or the policeman pulls you over for speeding. And the response would be, well, the Bible says, don't be too righteous. I was just being a little wicked. Let's think about the big picture here. Most of the time, I'm doing okay. Don't get too bent out of shape over something small. Be not overly righteous. It'll be okay. Let me off the hook, right? This idea of moderation, as far as right and wrong are concerned, or balance perhaps would be a word that's used. And unfortunately, that is how some scholars understand this passage. It's not just a child that might come to that conclusion. Some scholars actually take it in that way. And I think just on the surface of it, when you compare that interpretation to the rest of the Bible, we would be hard-pressed to conclude that this passage is telling you that, you know, as long as it's not too much, it's okay with the Lord. He's not going to care that much if you do a little bit of wickedness. And especially when in this same passage that I read, it speaks in verse 18 about fearing God somehow connected with it. How can he say out of one side of his mouth, fear God, and then out of the other side of his mouth, don't worry too much about God's morality? I don't think we want to approach it that way. What is the author here getting at with those kinds of statements? I think everything that we're going to see in this passage today, we have to keep connected to the leading statement, which is actually verse 15, the one that I skipped over momentarily. And actually, verse 15 is coming out of verses 13 and 14. You remember we ended there last time with this emphasis on God as the sovereign God doing things that we're not going to find enjoyable and that some of the things in our lives, as far as our circumstances are concerned, they are crooked. And if God has brought us to a kind of twisted time and taking us through a period of suffering, there is not anything we can do to change that. Our duty is simply to humbly bow before His providence. So following up on that, and all of this about God makes some things crooked, verse 15 says this, "In my vain life," which literally is in the days of my vapor, "in my vain life I have seen everything." And then he goes on to say, here are a couple of those many things, of that everything that I have observed, troubling things. "There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness." And the drift of that is that he perishes in spite of his righteousness. Even while he's maintaining a right approach to life and striving to obey God, he still dies. And the implication is he dies early. He dies in some way that you wouldn't expect. It's a surprising thing. It's an unfair thing. He doesn't deserve it, you might say. There is a righteous man who perishes in spite of his righteousness. And yet, on the other hand, sometimes there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. That is, in spite of his evil doing. He seems to be getting away with murder. Nothing bad happens to him, where, on the other hand, some of the quote-unquote good people end up suffering. And Solomon is very troubled about that. And he recognizes that we are troubled by it as well. This does not seem to make sense. This does not coincide with our view of God. And let me give you some illustrations here. One of each kind. How about this regarding the righteous man who perishes in spite of his righteousness? You may have heard back in July the names Jameson and Catherine Powles. 29 years old, and their three children, Ezra, who was 3, Violet, who was 23 months, Calvin, who was 2 months, and they had spent some time really seeking the Lord about serving Him in giving the gospel to the nations, and they had surrendered to missions, had been preparing for that, had been praying about that. And they get in their van to move temporarily to Colorado to complete their training. And on the way, a semi slams into their van and all 5 of them are whisked away into eternity. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. That doesn't make any sense. That's the sort of painful thing that Solomon is thinking about. On the other hand, what about the wicked who prolong his life? Well, what about this presidential election? Where you have both major candidates notorious for practicing and promoting sin, various kinds of very serious sin. And yet these people have been for many years incredibly successful financially and politically, while much more qualified candidates have been rejected and have failed in their efforts to lead this country. And I'm not saying these things to encourage you about who you should or shouldn't vote for. I'm just saying we probably are all just sitting here thinking, how did we end up with these two at the top, given all that they stand for? These are basically wicked people prospering, prolonging their lives and being successful. How can this be? So you've got this missionary family killed in an accident before they can even get to the field. You've got these other people who are prospering. We all struggle with these kinds of circumstances. This is inescapable in a fallen world. And it was even more troubling for the Israelites because they had Bible that they could appeal to argue against God doing this sort of thing. God had said to them as a nation and really as a part of their covenant, He had said things to them like this. This is Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 40. "Therefore you shall keep His statutes and His commandments, which I command you this today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days. Sounds like Ecclesiastes, that you may prolong your days in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for all time. And he worked all of this right into their covenant. There's this long list of blessings that if they obeyed would issue for the nation. There's a long list of curses that if they disobeyed, they would end up suffering. Well, that was in the Bible, but it was addressed to the nation as a whole. What the Israelites tended to do was also to read that into their individual lives as well, that God was always operating by the same principle. And they would also view it in a very rigid way, to where anomalies of life would cause them great consternation. They were troubled with this, maybe even more so than we are, because they're trying to filter this through the relatively little revelation that they had. And what they had to work with was the Mosaic Covenant, and it really didn't fit what happened in a lot of individual lives along the way. And that is the main issue that this passage is dealing with. And the individual statements all the way through need to be understood in that light. What Solomon is doing here is he is guiding us on how to respond when circumstances don't make sense or they seem downright unfair, these anomalies of life. And so our theme this morning is responding to life's anomalies, particularly the issue of the righteous suffering and the wicked prospering, responding to life's anomalies. And Solomon's going to lay out for us here three ways to respond. The first one, and getting to the passage I read about not being overly righteous, not being overly wicked, the point there, Solomon gives us this word, this response. He tells us, don't go to extremes. Don't go to extremes. Our third child is learning to drive. And she drove all the way home from church last Sunday. I'm thankful that we're here today. She's in the nursery this morning. So. But you know what it is when you're driving, that the problem of overcorrection, okay? So something happens over here, you're getting too close, and so you got to deal with this issue, but you can easily swing over too far in the other direction, and you're wacky over here, and you try to fix that, and you overcorrect, and it's just this back and forth, this extreme sort of handling of things. It's a part of learning how to drive, that you avoid overcorrecting, and some of us are still trying to learn. Well, the same thing happens in life. We can overreact, we can overcorrect when we're trying to think through a situation, trying to deal with a problem. The response ends up being extreme and not really addressing it, but actually creating more problems for us. We face an extreme situation and we respond in an extreme sort of way. And Solomon is warning us against those kinds of extremes. On the one hand, he does say, verse 16, be not overly righteous and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? And probably that's a little too strong. The word in this particular form means something like, why should you be confounded or astonished or dumbfounded or frustrated or confused, overwhelmed emotionally because of your overcorrection? But what does he mean when he says, don't be overly righteous and don't make yourself too wise? Well, again, keeping it very closely tied with verse 15, I believe this is what he's saying. When you see unjust suffering, you might conclude that the people that looked righteous and that are suffering, maybe they just weren't righteous enough. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe there was actually a breakdown in their righteousness. And so you decide you are going to be yourself intensely scrupulous in your conduct. And it's not just a matter of trying to do the right thing. It is doing the right thing, thinking that surely if you do, God will take note and God will protect you from harm because of your unusual, your very intense, your extreme devotion and righteousness. That seems to be the thrust of what he's saying. He's not somehow moderating God's law or telling you that it's okay to sin. He's addressing people who get very worked up about the righteous suffering. And what it does is it urges them to just get very intense about this, which is fine. But it's the mentality that's being addressed there. That somehow by doing that, sort of excelling in righteousness, you're going to be able to solve this problem and not face this kind of suffering in your life. I like the way that a friend of mine, Old Testament scholar Bob McCabe, translates it or paraphrases. He says, quote, "Do not be simplistically righteous with the expectation of immediate reward, neither be naively wise. Why cause yourself to be astonished that God did not honor your righteous living with immediate blessing?" Or we would say that this is basically a warning against a legalistic or a perfectionistic kind of mindset. And the problem isn't in the effort to do right. The problem is in trying to manipulate God through your efforts. In fact, one of the ways that you can translate that expression, "do not make yourself too wise," is to say, "do not be profitably wise." Our word profit that shows up a lot in Ecclesiastes is in there. Do not be profitably wise. In other words, don't be wise with the idea that this is really going to gain me an advantage with God, that this is going to be what's going to bring me profit and protection from Him. It's a self-oriented kind of thing. Ian Proven says this: "The crucial thing to be remembered about the universe is that God has created it. Wisdom is not a key that can be used in independence of the Creator to unlock the secrets of the universe, to shape existence after mortal desires, and to control life." You see, there's the idea of control. I'm arranging my life in a certain way to have it all together, and surely this is going to protect me, and I'm going to be able to get all the goals that I have set out for myself. Although certain ways of being and behaving are wiser than others and in general tend toward life rather than death, yet in the end we must remember that the universe is not a predictable machine, but a personally governed and complex space. Wisdom is not magic. God is not an object to be manipulated, nor does God's world belong to human beings. If God makes something crooked, it is beyond human power to make it straight. You see what he's saying there? That we can easily come to view the efforts we're making to do the right thing as somehow guaranteeing a certain outcome. If we just tick these things off the list, you know, it's like a formula before God. If God views us as doing this and not doing the other, then he is on our side and he's going to protect us and he's going to cushion our lives and he's going to give us what we want. We would say this verse is a warning against prosperity theology. Okay? And it's not an issue of righteousness or not righteous. It's about your motives. It's about why you're doing it. What is driving you? And this verse, it's interesting. It is talking about life under the sun, right? Talking about physical life and people dying young or dying in some calamity. Life under the sun. But how much more would it apply to life, as we might say, above the sun? If I cannot impress God enough to guarantee me a long and happy life on earth, how can I possibly impress him enough to guarantee me eternal life and bliss in heaven? Okay. People get materialistic and into this prosperity theology, thinking I do these things for God, he blesses me. And then we so easily transfer that to the eternal issues, and we're operating in the same mindset. And it's like, this doesn't even work on earth. How do you think it's going to work as far as eternal issues? Don't go to that extreme of thinking that by just being really righteous and excelling over other people, somehow you're going to be free from calamity. Now, that's one overcorrection. This kind of perfectionistic, controlling, materialistic sort of thing. Some people don't think in those terms. Some people have another mentality. And that's what is being addressed in verse 17 when he says, "Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time?" He's saying, look, the answer is not only to resist this perfectionistic thinking, but it is also not to just give up. In other words, somebody might say, well, if living a righteous life isn't going to guarantee me prosperity, then what's the point? Who cares? It's not going to help me. I'm just going to forget the whole idea and just live doing whatever I feel like doing. So you got legalism on one hand, you got license on the other, with the thought, look, the righteous prosper, and you know, a lot of wicked people do get away with it, so hey, I'm going to play my chances, and maybe I'll be one of those people. Playing your chances is a lot more fun anyway. So we're just going to throw off all more restrictions, since there's not this sort of righteousness equals blessing on earth, and we're just going to do whatever we feel like and see what happens. Now, you might still wonder with that idea about the word overly there, be not overly wicked, because it might imply that it's okay to be a little bit wicked. And we know that we're not supposed to be any kind of wicked. Okay. Well, very shortly, even in this message and in the following from this passage, Solomon is going to make a huge point about human depravity and about the fact that all humans do sin. And so he is not going to word this warning so as not to contradict that. In other words, he's not going to warn us against wickedness such that we could conceive that somehow in this life we actually would be totally 100% free of wickedness. This passage is not a general statement about life. It is not a general statement about our sanctification. It is addressing the issue in context, which is unjust suffering. The passage later on is going to allow for our fallibility. It's going to say it's just a fact of life that you fail. What he's warning when he says don't be overly wicked is he is warning against the idea of an all-out pursuit of wickedness. The apathy that some people have as they look at the world and how it works because of the curse of sin, and they're just saying, look, I'm just going to go whole hog for sin and for myself. By Solomon saying, be not overly wicked, he's saying, don't pursue that kind of licentious lifestyle, thinking that somehow it's the solution to this problem about the suffering of the righteous. And he equates that as well with folly. He says, be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. And notice that at that point, there isn't a comparative. He doesn't say, just don't be more than half a fool or something. This is a more absolute statement. And in fact, this word for fool is one of the stronger Hebrew words for fool that speaks of somebody who is stubborn and who is resistant. Those two ideas are parallel. For him to say, don't be overly righteous, as in don't live whole hog for yourself. The same thing as saying, don't lead a life of folly. The idea of whether you might still fail in sin, that's a separate question. That's not under discussion quite yet. We're talking here about warning people not to respond to the injustices of life by just turning their backs completely on God and living a life of all-out sin. And if those people do want to play their chances, the final statement is very sobering. Why should you die before your time? You don't know that you're going to be an exception. You really are gambling with your life and destiny. You don't have any guarantees that somehow you're personally going to escape the pattern that sin brings suffering on earth. You really don't want to overreact to this problem in that way and give yourself over to sin. Don't go to extremes. And as he rounds that out in verse 18, he's going to summarize the point and he's going to get at his bottom line perspective. Listen to verse 18. It says, it is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. For the one who fears God shall come out from, or better, with both of them. And the question here is, what is the this? It is good that you should take hold of this. What is the this? And from that withhold not your hand. What is the that you're not supposed to withhold your hand from? And it's a reference back to verses 16 and 17. And the two words of warning that he has given you. Don't don't withhold your hand from this bit of counsel, not to be overly wicked. Take hold of this bit of counsel, on the other hand. Don't be overly righteous in the way that we have defined it. So take hold of this warning. Don't view righteousness as a form of manipulating God. Take hold of this warning also. Don't become apathetic and give yourself over to wickedness. Embrace both of the warnings of Solomon, both of the things he has just said. And this is what people who fear God do. And that's the last part of this point about the extremes. Not only that you avoid the extremes, but that what is going to help you avoid them is a right relationship with God. You are a God-fearing person. There's the bottom line. And this is the third time so far in this book that Solomon has addressed the issue of fearing God that's becoming more and more important to him. If you and I are rightly oriented to God, if we are living in the awareness of Him as our Creator, if we are bowing before His sovereignty, if we are yielding to His Word, if we are striving by His grace to avoid the displeasure that goes on when we disobey Him, if that is our attitude, God is God, He is the ruler, He determines my circumstances, He also determines the moral requirements for my life. Depending on Him, that's the path I'm going to follow. If I have that kind of posture toward God, of just recognizing Him and accepting Him and yielding to Him as the ruler, then I'm not going to need, on the one hand, to manipulate Him, because I've accepted He's sovereign. And I can't really bargain with God. That's not what my righteousness is about. And if, as well, that's my viewpoint, that I accept Him as Lord and I fear Him, then I'm certainly not going to dismiss Him like the utterly wicked person either. So it is in this right orientation to God and just the humble acceptance of Him as the sovereign and yielding to Him and to His plan for my life that I am able to avoid those two extremes. I will humbly take my place as a creature, and I will accept His providences, and I will trust that His ways are wiser and better than I can even imagine. And if that's my view of God, then I'm going to avoid the extremes. Avoiding extremes is the first response to life's anomalies. And here's the second in verses 19 to 22. Keep pursuing wisdom. Keep pursuing wisdom. Very clearly in verse 19, wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. And it's like he does in so many other places in Ecclesiastes. He makes one statement. He has to sort of balance it out over here. And he says one kind of negative thing about righteousness or wisdom, and he has to come back and say a positive so you won't misunderstand. You'll keep the whole thing together. So he has already made the point that wisdom is not going to preserve you from all the problems that are out there. Here he is basically saying, but it is going to protect you from a lot of them. Okay, so don't throw wisdom out the window just because it's not in an ironclad way going to sort of shore up your life and free you from every possible bit of suffering. It won't preserve you from all problems, but it will protect you from a lot of them. In fact, it's going to make you more effective than those who are mighty in the world's eyes. He speaks here of wisdom giving you strength more than 10 rulers who are in a city. The number 10 there speaks of a full number, a complete collection of influential people in authority in the world. And yet he's saying often it's the common people whose lives are more effective, whose lives are more at peace, whose lives are more compelling, because they are just humbly trusting God, trying to make skillful choices to honor Him. Those are more compelling people often than those who are in power. Keep pursuing wisdom, even though it's not going to save you from every possible calamity. Keep pursuing it. It has the potential to make you stronger than 10 men who are ruling a city. And as he goes on, again, we've got to keep all this tightly connected. He's still talking about this when he goes on to verse 20. He's actually going to be giving us here some reasons, or a main reason, that we need God to give us this wisdom so desperately. It is because of our innate depravity as human beings. Verse 20 in our translation begins with the word surely. If you have a King James Version, it translates it with the word for. The little particle there could actually go either way. And as you read the logic of this passage, I believe that for is actually better, because it's giving you an explanation. It's keeping all of this connected. It's explaining the reason that you and I still need to keep pursuing wisdom. And here's the reason: because there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. You know how I've commented several times about mistrusting or distrusting yourself, not assuming that you're right, not assuming that you've got this all figured out. Okay? He's saying the same thing here by reminding you of our innate depravity as human beings. That's why you need God's wisdom so desperately. And Solomon had said almost word for word the same thing back when in 1 Kings chapter 8, he had been praying at the dedication of the temple. Maybe you remember that passage. And he's asking for the Lord to bless this place and that he would hear prayers of confession and accept these sacrifices offered in this place. Why? He says, because there's not a man who never sins. We need this place of atonement and confession and reconciliation, because we are broken people who by nature, this is our direction. There is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. And maybe Paul had this very statement in his mind when he wrote Romans 3:10. It sounds a lot like that statement. We all have this bent to sin. Left to our own devices, we will go in a sinful direction. Even after regeneration and all that we've received in Christ, of actually being called saints as his people and the Holy Spirit living within us, we still have a powerful remnant of this in our lives in what the Bible, the New Testament, calls the flesh. And that is why you and I need to, all through life, no matter how old we are, develop a healthy measure of distrust in ourselves, not to take anything for granted, not to assume that our thinking is correct, always checking our thoughts against God's word, seeking counsel as we make our way through life. We seek his wisdom. We cry out to him for his direction. That desperateness that Proverbs talks about, that you are on a search for it, just like somebody who is on a hunt for gold or for treasure. That's the spirit. Keep pursuing it. Why? Because internally I have this force in me that is always bending me to the wrong direction. I've got this power of sin. And when you go on to verses 21 and 22, he's still talking about the same thing, only it's an illustration. Initially, when you read this verse, it's like, what in the world does this have to do with this? Listen to verse 21. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. Why all of a sudden does he start talking about not paying attention too much to what other people are saying about you? Well, that's not really the main point. He's setting up one illustration as he's talking about human depravity. That's what he's getting at, is let's look at this little slice of life and prove what I'm saying about your bent to sin. Here we are, and we are so prone to criticize others, and we're so prone to get offended when others criticize us, and we are so outraged when somebody impugns us or goes after us. And not that that's to be justified, not that he's dismissing that problem, but he's saying, you know what, have you ever considered that probably you have said or at least thought some of those same things about other people, and that in heart you really aren't different from the individual who's saying all these mean things? It's a very humbling recognition here. He's driving home deeper and deeper the theme of our depravity. even while we are condemning other people for saying things out of line, we, our consciences, are convicting us of the same kinds of things. And our depravity is such, and our need for God's wisdom is so great, because of this problem of hypocrisy. We need God's wisdom, not just because we naturally do wrong things, but because we are also given to sort of minimizing and denying in some way our faults. Now, it is not too hard to criticize Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But as I have thought about this and read what people are saying, and everybody's outraged. And Tony made a comment like this in Sunday school this morning. I have had to think about myself. And I have had to just preach to myself something along these lines. There is nothing that Donald Trump has said or done that I am not capable of doing. There is nothing that Hillary Clinton has done that I'm not capable of doing. The same bent to sin, the same carnality, the same strife, the same ambition, the same selfishness, the same pride. By the grace of God, hopefully that has been restrained, and there is the ability to resist the sin, but the flesh is the same. We are not better than any of these people. And I think a verse like this, particularly a time like this, ought to be a warning against the kind of self-righteousness that goes on when we are talking about other people's failures. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed other people. Have I possibly engaged in the same kind of thing, at least in terms of my own thought life and my motive? Have I committed the same sins, in essence, if not in such a big and obvious way? All of us have plenty of cause to be humbled and to cast ourselves on the Lord for direction and grace to fight against our depravity. That's why we need His wisdom. And when we see all these weird things going on in the world, yes, they need to be addressed. Yes, we need to make wise choices. Yes, we need to strive to be an influence for God in the world. But they ought also to move us to examine our hearts, to own up to our depravity, and to pursue more of the wisdom of God in our lives. That is one of the right responses to the anomalies of life and all the wickedness that is out there that is sometimes prospering and succeeding. He says, let it drive you to something different. Let it drive you to a recognition of your need and to a pursuit of God for wisdom. And number three, verses 23 and 24, another and final response to the anomalies of life. And I won't say much about it because we've seen this repeatedly in Ecclesiastes. And here again, Solomon is kind of balancing out ideas. So he's talked about how we need to avoid these extremes, and yet he's cautioned us that wisdom still has value and we need to pursue it. And now he's back to talking about the limitations of wisdom, that wisdom's not going to do everything for you. And so verses 23 and 24 urge us to accept our ignorance. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise. But it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? And as we think back on the two scenarios I started with, I mean, that's what we're looking at. Some of these things are very deep. I don't know what the answer is. I cannot figure this out. And it's very comforting to me that even Solomon admitted it. Have you ever stood on the top of a mountain or at the edge of a canyon or on the expanse of a seashore and you've thought, this is huge, this is massive. I feel so small. I cannot begin to understand how all of this works or how it all got here. I cannot begin to understand how God created this just by His simple word. I cannot I cannot comprehend how he is even to this day sustaining it all, functioning by his word. You might go back home and you might read a book about the mountain or about the ocean, try to grasp some general idea of it, but you very quickly recognize that you are out of your league, way out of your league. And mostly, the more you learn about it, you just find yourself befuddled by your ignorance and you find yourself more and more humble. That's how you feel when you're standing in front of some huge force, some huge element of nature. And it is also the kind of feeling that Solomon says he had as he considered the circumstances of people's lives and some of these crooked things that God in his providence brings into our lives. He says God's ways are deep, deep, unfathomable. And again, you wonder if Paul had this in mind when he, in Romans 11, ended that whole discussion of the mysteries of God's sovereignty and man's responsibilities. He really doesn't have an answer that resolves it. He gives us certain perspectives that have to be there. But at the end of the day, he leaves a lot of room for mystery. And here's what he says. He doesn't complain. He doesn't argue against God. He just says, oh, the depths of the wisdom. The depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his ways. His ways are past finding out. It leaves him humbled. It leaves him worshiping. That's where he ends. And even while Solomon learns a great deal about God's world and how to navigate, he is content to admit his inabilities and his ignorance and ultimately to trust and to worship the Creator. It is healthy for us to admit our ignorance. And that has got to be one of the responses to life's anomalies. And as a student, you're kind of discouraged, but also kind of encouraged when a teacher tells you, I don't know. And you're also encouraged as a ministerial student when somebody who's been in the ministry a long time, talking about trying to help people with their problems and counseling them through suffering, will often say to you, don't try to give them an answer. Don't try to interpret this. You don't have the answer. These are the ways of God. Just love them. Just encourage them to trust a God who in so many ways has proven himself trustworthy. And let's just leave it at that and let God minister to them the comfort and the help that they need. That's the spirit of this text. And Solomon was able to get there, to put himself in that humble position of trust. And it strikes me that from a New Testament standpoint, you and I have even more reason to have that same spirit of trust. Listen to this, these comparisons, these connections with the New Testament. We're talking here about anomalies and the righteous suffering. Was there anybody else righteous who suffered? Jesus Christ submitted himself to this cursed world of anomalies. And he became the ultimate righteous sufferer. Was there anything good that came out of his unjust suffering? Through his unfair suffering, Christ provides us the righteousness that we could never attain. We were instructed here about our sinfulness and really that no matter how hard we try, there's still this bent to sin and these failings in our lives and who deals with that? Who makes up for it? Well, it was Christ, by facing unjust suffering, provided a standing of perfection for us before the throne of God. And although he still, at this point, has not chosen to answer all of our questions, he still provides us with a wealth of wisdom in the New Testament way beyond what Solomon ever conceived. And he begins to fill in some, not all, but some of the gaps in Solomon's knowledge as to the purposes of God in suffering. And finally, through Christ, our Father is moving history toward its consummation, where finally all of this will be fixed and all of these wrongs will be made right in the time and in the plan of God. We have more than Solomon did to humble ourselves before the Lord, to encourage us to pursue God's wisdom, to avoid these extreme responses. May we continue to grow in trust.